To listen ad-free, visit us on Patreon at patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also get this show ad-free on Apple subscriptions. See your Apple Podcast app for more details. Anatomy of a Massacre discusses topics that might not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On August 1st, 2017, a middle-aged former accountant broke two windows of his high roller suite on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino with a hammer. Moments later, he holstered an AR-15 rifle equipped with armor-piercing bullets. He began firing into a crowd of 22,000 concert-goers. At first, the rapid sounds of gunfire sounded like fireworks. But as the hail of bullets intensified, the crowd quickly realized what was happening. Over 1,000 bullets were fired into the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival crowd that night, leaving 58 people dead and hundreds more injured. Two more victims died in the months following the shooting, bringing the count to 60 dead. The 2017 Route 91 Harvest Music Festival became the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. But even after all of these years, there are still so many unanswered questions. The biggest question? Why? This is Anatomy of a Massacre, Rockefeller Audio's newest podcast series, episode number one, the 2017 Route 91 Harvest Music Festival mass shooting in Las Vegas. Anatomy of a Massacre is a true crime podcast investigating the most notorious massacres in human history, from serial killers to mass shooters to genocides. There's a new story to be told in each episode. As a one-woman show, your support helps me conduct research and assist with production and editing costs. As a thank you for supporting the show, you'll get early ad-free access to episodes, personalized shoutouts and episodes, exclusive merchandise, bonus content, and more. To learn about how you can support Anatomy of a Massacre, please visit patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre or simply click the link in the show notes. Other ways to support the show include leaving a positive rating with a review or telling friends about the show. Now, let's get into the episode. This episode discusses sensitive subjects, including suicide. Suicide prevention and resources are included at the end of the episode. Sunday, October 1st, 2017, 9:40 p.m. Country mega superstar Jason Aldean took the stage to perform in front of 22,000 people. The former truck driver was scheduled to be the closing act of the three-day Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas, Nevada. The multi-day event was held at an open-air concert venue directly across from the Las Vegas Strip and the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. Jason Aldean got on stage and began singing his hit, When She Says Baby. It was 10:05 p.m., just as the crowd began to sing along, they were interrupted by something that sounded like fireworks. Cell phone video captured many concert goers assuring their friends the noise was firecrackers, crazy drunk Las Vegas party animals playing a mean joke. But within seconds, the loud bangs amplified. Soon, everyone attending the Route 91 Harvest Festival realized it wasn't firecrackers. Instead, it was the sound of gunfire. In less than 60 seconds, more than 100 rounds were fired into the crowd. And before anyone could realize what was happening, Las Vegas 911 dispatchers were inundated with emergency phone calls.
911, do you need police, fire, or medical?
Medical, police, plumbers, is dying in a bad accident.
Oh, what? God. What's going on?
We need paramedics. And so many people, they're out the car.
We got them on the way, okay?
All right.
Can you tell me if you are involved? Did you witness
it? I am not involved. I'm just coming up. There's cars smoking. Commerce and Cheyenne right in the intersection, and they're across into the Vegas Trade Village in the dirt.
We'll send someone out there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Jesus Campos, a security guard at the Mandalay Bay, was about to finish his shift for the evening. But before clocking out to go home, he received a service call about a room alarm going off on the 32nd floor. So Jesus Campos took the elevator up to the 30th floor. Campos then took the stairs up two more floors to the 32nd floor. But he was blocked when he tried to step out into the stairwell. There was a metal L bracket screwed into the door, preventing him or anyone else from opening it. He decided to take the stairs up to the 33rd floor, then took the elevator back down to the 32nd floor. Seconds after stepping into the hallway of the 32nd floor, he heard what sounded like someone using a power drill. Before he could figure out where the drilling was coming from, he was shot at 10:06 p.m. Over the next horrific 4 minutes, 240 deadly seconds, more than 250 more rounds were fired into the crowd of innocent concert goers. Additional shots were fired in the direction of McCarran International Airport. People began lying on top of loved ones and complete strangers to shield them from the hail of bullets that seemed to be falling out of the sky. Others were forced to run and leave their injured friends and family behind. Soon, Las Vegas police officers found themselves in a gun battle. The situation caused immediate confusion for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Reports came in about multiple shooters throughout the Las Vegas Strip. One call came in about a shooting at the Tropicana Resort. Later on, that report turned out to be false. There was even suspicion about a possible coordinated terrorist attack. Initially, the Las Vegas police didn't realize that the shooter was coming from only one location on the Las Vegas Strip, room 32135 at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. At 10:12 p.m., 7 minutes after the first shooting, police officers inside the Mandalay Bay realized the shots were coming from a room inside the hotel. 1 minute later, at 10:13 p.m., police officers stationed outside the hotel pinpointed the shot's origin. Then at 10:15 p.m., everything went silent. For the first time in 11 minutes, the shooting stopped. Between 10:17 and 10:24 p.m., 10 Las Vegas police officers arrived on the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay. The officers were met by Jesus Campos, the security guard who was shot while responding to the room alarm. He directed the officers to the room where the shooting was coming from. It would be almost another 60 minutes before officers would break into room 32135. At 11:20 p.m., 1 hour and 5 minutes after the first shots, a police SWAT unit detonated an explosive device to break down the door to room 32135. Moments later, a second explosive device was used to open a second closed door inside the room. 2 minutes before midnight, at 11:58 p.m., the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department confirmed that one shooter had been identified, Stephen Paddock. The department tweeted, confirming that one suspect is down. This is an active investigation. Again, please do not head down to the Strip at this time. At the end of the night, Stephen Paddock shot and killed 58 people and injured more than 800 people before turning the gun on himself. Those injured suffered from gunshot wounds, shrapnel injuries, and other injuries related to the shooting. The youngest victim killed was only 20 years old, and the oldest victim was 67. She was a mother of three and grandmother to 9 grandchildren. 33 people of those killed that night were parents. Others were college students. Some were business owners and lawyers, while others worked in restaurants, finance, and construction. 2 victims were at the concert to celebrate their recent retirement. The massacre was officially over 2 hours and 26 minutes after it began at 12:31 a.m. on October 2, 2017, becoming the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Room 32-135 sat on the 32nd floor of the 43-story hotel on the Las Vegas Strip. The luxury high-roller suite sprawled across over 1,700 square feet. It offered its guests an 180-degree view of the Strip with floor-to-ceiling windows. There was a full-size bar, a separate bedroom and living area, and 2 televisions. In 2017, the suite ran guests for around $500 a night. On Monday, September 25th, 2017, 1 week before the shooting, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock checked into room 32-135 at the Mandalay Bay just before 3 o'clock p.m. That afternoon, he made his usual 70-minute drive in his Hyundai Tucson SUV from his home in Mesquite, Nevada, to the Las Vegas Strip. Mesquite, Nevada is approximately 74 miles northeast of Las Vegas. Stephen Paddock was a regular at Mandalay Bay. Since he was known to spend a lot of money in the casinos during his frequent trips to Las Vegas, the hotel designated him a high roller with VIP treatment. As a result, anytime Paddock stayed at the Mandalay Bay, he received stellar customer service, and when he checked into his suite on September 25th, 2017, things were no different. After checking in at the VIP counter, the hotel staff handed Paddock a special key to use the hotel's service elevators to access his room. This access meant that Paddock could bring whatever he wanted into his suite without other hotel guests or staff noticing. As a VIP, he could use the service elevators so he wouldn't have to wait for the public elevators that were often crowded. Throughout the week leading up to the shooting, hotel security cameras meticulously captured Paddock's every move. Cameras caught him making a purchase at one of the hotel gift shops. He was seen sitting at slot machines and video poker machines. At one point, cameras positioned above the VIP front desk captured Paddock speaking with a hotel employee. Later on, records confirmed he reserved an adjoining suite next to his, 32-134, using his girlfriend's name. In an interview with Nightline, Deputy Chief Andrew Walsh of the Las Vegas Metro Police said that Paddock didn't do anything to stand out during his stay. Walsh described him as, quote, "He just looked like a middle-aged guy with a lot of luggage coming to his room," end quote. During his stay at Mandalay Bay, Paddock made several trips back to his house in Mesquite, Nevada, 70 miles away. Each time he returned to the Las Vegas Strip, he brought more bags and suitcases. In total, Paddock brought in 21 suitcases. When Las Vegas Metro police officers and SWAT team entered Paddock's suite and the adjacent room he reserved under his girlfriend's name, they seized a total of 24 firearms, including AR-15s and AR-10s equipped with armor-piercing bullets. Some of the guns had been altered with bump stocks, a device that can be installed on semi-automatic guns to make them fire rounds quicker. Both suites were trashed with bullets. The authorities recovered more than 1,000 spent shell casings and over 5,000 unused rounds of ammunition inside both rooms. Hidden surveillance cameras were found inside and outside of the rooms. A black Logitech camera had been placed on a dirty hotel room service cart just outside the room in the lobby. Another camera was taped into the room's peephole. In one of the living rooms, police found a blue plastic tube with a snorkel mouthpiece on one end and on a fan on the other. The master bedroom had a snorkeling kit, including a scuba mask. On a notepad next to the phone, there was a handwritten note where Paddock wrote, "Unplug the phones." On another pink piece of paper, there were handwritten measurements with distance and bullet drop calculations from his room on the 32nd floor. No suicide note or manifesto was found inside the hotel room or at Paddock's house. A search of his computers revealed even more disturbing details. For nearly 7 months leading up to the shooting, Paddock made multiple Google searches for open-air concert venues, Las Vegas SWAT tactics, and the expected number of people attending the concert. Besides his searches related to the shooting, the FBI recovered several hundred images of child pornography on the hard drive of one of his computers. On August 8, 2018, 10 months after the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, the Las Vegas Metro Police announced they had concluded their investigation. The 187-page report was called the LVMPD Criminal Investigative Report of the October 1st mass casualty shooting.
By all accounts, Stephen Paddock was an unremarkable man whose movements leading up to October 1st didn't raise any suspicion. An interview with his doctor indicated signs of a troubled mind, but no troubling behavior that would trigger a call to law enforcement.
The report carefully laid out the department's findings. They explained they knew almost everything about Stephen Paddock, except one thing. What motivated a middle-aged man and former real estate agent to perpetrate the deadliest mass shooting massacre in modern American history? After following up with 2,000 leads, watching 22,000 hours of video, and viewing 252,000 images, the Las Vegas police believed Paddock acted alone. There was no evidence he was part of any organized terrorist organization, either foreign or national. He had no history of involvement in any hate group, and he didn't have a criminal record. Paddock was born in Iowa and was the youngest of four boys. In a New York Times article, he was described as the least angry of the four brothers. He was also described as the most boring. His father, Patrick Benjamin Paddock, was primarily absent when Stephen was growing up. His criminal career began long before his sons were born. His crimes included writing bad checks, robbing banks, and stealing cars. He was on the FBI's most wanted list from 1969 to 1977. When Patrick Paddock went to prison, Stephen's mom, Dolores Irene Hudson, raised Stephen and his three siblings on a secretary salary. Stephen graduated from John H. Francis Polytechnic Senior High School in Los Angeles in 1971. He worked nights at an airport while taking college classes at California State University, Northridge. After that, he worked as a postal worker for the U.S. Postal Service during the mid to late 1970s. After his time at the Post Service, he briefly worked as an IRS agent and auditor for the Defense Contract Audit Agency. On the side, he ran a real estate business with his brother, Eric. It's in the business of real estate where Stephen seemed to hit financial freedom. In 1987, Stephen and his brother bought a 30-unit building near the University of California College campus in Los Angeles. From then, they purchased multiple multifamily properties throughout California and Texas. In 2012, he sold a property in Texas for more than $8 million. Once he sold off the rest of his real estate businesses, Stephen was reported to be worth just over $2 million. Stephen had been married and divorced twice. His first marriage lasted 3 years in the late 1970s, and his second marriage lasted 5 years in the mid-1980s. In 2016, Stephen moved out of a retirement community in Melbourne, Florida, and purchased a home in Mesquite, Nevada. He lived in Mesquite with his girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, who he had met a few years earlier. She got a job booking sports bets at a local casino in Mesquite. Stephen was an avid gambler. On one occasion, he stayed in a Las Vegas hotel for 4 months straight gambling. A gambling industry analyst who reported for the New York Times described Stephen as a mid-level high roller. This meant he was someone who could afford to lose $100,000 in one sitting. This happened on several occasions at the Red Rock Casino in Las Vegas. His preferred game of choice was video poker. Before sitting down to play, he would study the pay tables, which would tell them what each possible winning hand paid out, a practice that all successful video pokers do before sitting down at a machine. He was also known to participate in casino promotions. For one particular casino promotion, Stephen got to the casino 2 hours before it started and reserved two video poker machines. Then when the promotion started, he played the machines for 14 hours straight and wouldn't let anyone else on the machine. As a mid-level high roller, he was in good standing with all MGM Grand properties across the Las Vegas Strip. When he stayed in Las Vegas, the MGM provided him a credit line of $100,000, but he would usually never use the total amount. The extent of Stephen's gambling winnings over his 25 years of playing video poker isn't clear. The Las Vegas Police Department's report stated that Stephen's financial assets had diminished in the recent months and years, but he didn't owe anyone money, and his gambling debts had been all paid off. The report noted that in the months leading up to the shooting, Stephen was stockpiling firearms. He purchased his first gun in 1982, but his interest in guns suddenly changed in the months leading up to October 2017. He began buying dozens of guns, many of which were high-powered rifles, including AR-10s and AR-15s. He also stockpiled thousands of rounds of ammunition. Packages were starting to arrive at Stephen's house almost every single day. According to the report, Stephen legally purchased all of his guns and ammunition. Most of the guns were purchased at either gun shows or gun shops. The only person criminally charged for selling to Stephen was Douglas Hayes of Mesa, Arizona. Douglas was sentenced to 13 months in prison for illegally manufacturing ammunition for Stephen. The criminal complaint alleged that he was the firearm dealer who sold armor-piercing rounds. In September 2017, 1 month before the shooting, Stephen and his girlfriend stayed at the Mandalay Bay together. According to his girlfriend, during the trip, Stephen was often preoccupied with looking out the hotel's windows. He constantly moved around the room to get different views of the windows. But Mary Lou said his behavior wasn't out of character. She said that Stephen's behavior had turned strange in the months leading up to October 2017. Stephen met Mary Lou when she was working as a high-limits casino host. Initially, their relationship was romantic, but she told the police that she had recently noticed their relationship becoming distant. She attributed the change to Stephen's declining health. Mary Lou said that Stephen frequently suffered from bad headaches. His hands had become extremely sensitive to the point that he usually wore gloves and refused to shake people's hands. The official report outlines that right before Stephen left for Las Vegas to execute his massacre, he paid his girlfriend to travel to the Philippines to see her family. While she was there, he also wired her $115,000, where he said it was to buy a house in the Philippines. When authorities sat down and spoke with the girlfriend, she said she thought Stephen was trying to break up with her. She had no idea he planned to orchestrate a mass shooting during his trip to Las Vegas. She said she believed the money was to keep her away. The August 2018 report stated that the massacre didn't meet the federal standards or definition of a terrorist attack. By definition, what happened on October 1st, 2017 was a mass shooting, not a terrorist attack. Although in a public statement made available by the New York Times, Las Vegas Sheriff Lombardo said, quote, "I would personally call it a terrorist attack," end quote. The release of the 2018 criminal investigative report of the October 1st mass casualty shooting attempted to provide closure. Closure for the victims, their families, and every single American. The report provided many details about who Stephen Paddock was, the events that happened in the days and hours before the shooting. But the report didn't answer one burning question: why? To answer this why, the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit published its own report in January of 2019. In the report, the FBI wrote, quote, "No single or clear motivating factor drove Stephen Paddock's killing rampage and subsequent suicide," end quote. The FBI reported that Stephen's actions weren't driven by a religious, social, or political agenda and that he acted alone. The report said, quote, "Throughout his life, Paddock went to great lengths to keep his thoughts private, and that extended to his final thinking about his mass murder," end quote. The FBI noted that they believed part of Stephen's motivation was his desire to die by suicide and to also attain a certain degree of infamy via a mass casualty attack. The report described Stephen's declining physical and mental health in the months leading up to the shooting as possible motives. There was also mention that his father's criminal history may have influenced Stephen's decision to execute his plan. But the FBI's report concluded that these are simply theories about a possible motive. The real explanation behind Stephen Paddock's behavior isn't known. Extensive research on mass shootings tells us that the vast majority of shooters are male. In one research study published by Psychology Today, 90% of mass shooters in the United States are male, and 55% of these males are white. But being a male doesn't necessarily make someone at greater risk of becoming a killer. Over the years, research hasn't been able to identify individual factors that can predict or explain why someone becomes a mass shooter. Instead, research on mass shootings focuses on the interaction of social, psychological, and biological factors that contribute to mass shooting events. If we can understand that relationship, we can hopefully better understand what puts someone at greater risk of becoming a mass murderer. Although there aren't specific factors that explain or predict why someone becomes a mass shooter, these individuals do have traits in common. So let's discuss those traits and see if Stephen Paddock had any of them. Besides gender, mass shooters share several common traits. The first is the feeling of inadequacy. These individuals may feel inadequate compared to their peers, which creates long-term insecurity. As a result, they often have low self-esteem. Because Stephen kept to himself and lived a very private life, little is known about his self-esteem. But there are aspects to his life that may or may not explain his level of self-esteem or feelings of inadequacy. Number one, his childhood. Stephen's father, Benjamin Paddock, was an infamous bank robber who spent years on the FBI's most wanted list after escaping prison in 1969. Throughout Stephen's childhood, his father was absent. When Stephen was relatively young, his father was sent to prison for the first time. This left Stephen and his siblings to be raised by their mother, but she wasn't around that much either because she had to support the family. It's possible that Stephen's lack of attention at home from either his mother or father contributed to his low self-esteem. Research on this topic suggests that absent parents can contribute to low self-esteem in children, among other adverse effects. Let's return to the examination of his father. Benjamin Paddock was a famous bank robber. Some mass shooters express a desire to become famous for their crimes. They want their name to be known. They want to go down in history as this prolific mass murderer. So they have an element of fame-seeking to them. Some people speculate whether Stephen also possessed this desire. His father was a famous bank robber and criminal. Maybe growing up, Stephen saw the fame that his father achieved by crime. And then when he grew up, some part of him wanted to accomplish the same recognition or even outdo his father. Number two, his private and reclusive lifestyle. According to the FBI's report on Stephen, he led a very private life. This includes his decision to commit the shooting and his suicide. But having a private life doesn't necessarily mean someone, including Stephen, has low self-esteem. Living with low self-esteem can cause harm to your mental health and may cause someone to live a more private life. But living a private life doesn't mean you have low self-esteem. Many people choose to live private and happy lives, fulfilled lives, and have high self-esteem. Number three, his compulsive gambling. According to research, pathological gamblers have been found to have lower self-esteem compared to non-gamblers. They also experience greater mood disturbances and more likely to participate in risk-taking behaviors to gain excitement. For years, Stephen was a frequent visitor of high roller casinos in Las Vegas and other casinos throughout Nevada. Because of his regular visits to Las Vegas, the Mandalay Bay designated him as a guest with VIP treatment. He was someone who could gamble and lose up to $100,000 in simply one session. He would be at a video poker machine all night and then sleep during the day. Most mass shooters here in the United States are in their mid-30s, and most are either single or divorced. The average age for a shooter is 36 years old, and most fall between the ages of 20 and 50 years old. In this case, Stephen doesn't fall into that category. He was 64, which is relatively old for a mass shooter. Besides him, there have been only three other mass shooters over the age of 60 in modern U.S. history. There was William Baker, who killed four coworkers in 2001 when he was 66. In 2013, 64-year-old Kurt Myers killed four people. 62-year-old Carl Drega killed four people, including two police officers, in 1997. Then 66-year-old James Hutchinson shot and killed four people at a congressional baseball game for charity in June 2017. So when it comes to mass shooters, Stephen was old. Most criminologists would probably argue that Stephen should have aged out of crime. So for a 64-year-old to execute the deadliest mass shooting incident in modern history is exceptionally unusual. And it doesn't fit the mold for your typical mass shooter. Now let's examine his marital status. Most mass shooters are divorced or single. Up to 75% of them are single. In Stephen's case, he fits that statistic. Before the shooting, he had been married and divorced twice. Although he had a girlfriend at the time, she described Stephen as distant. So even though they may have technically been in a relationship, he wasn't affectionate. He was distant with her, physically and emotionally. He was known to come and go whenever he wanted. If Stephen wanted to do something, he did it. These are behaviors that most single people do. And in terms of a divorce, we know that he was divorced twice. Besides age, One trait that makes Stephen different from your typical mass shooter is his ideology. Many mass shooters believe in an extreme ideology. It might be about race, religion, or even politics. And these radical ideologies can help explain the motive behind the shooting. But when it comes to Stephen, the Las Vegas police and FBI both agreed that they didn't find any evidence that he had any extreme beliefs or ideologies. He wasn't associated with any radical religious or political groups. Despite reports about Stephen disliking former President Barack Obama and showing support for Donald Trump, there was no evidence he was political. And when it came to religion, his girlfriend told the FBI that Stephen had recently commented her, quote, "Your God doesn't love me," end quote. Although Mary Lou would attend church services twice a week, Stephen would never go with her. She would always go by herself. In fact, he was never reported to attend any church regularly. If the Las Vegas police or FBI found evidence that Stephen believed in some extreme ideology, I think we'd be able to find a motive. Or at least it would help us understand why he might have done what he did. If a shooter is found to be racist, we can say they were motivated by their hatred of a particular race. If the same thing can be said about religion. But when someone doesn't have a history of hate towards a particular race or religion, the motive can be quite difficult to identify. And that's exactly the case with Stephen Paddock. The police and FBI found no racial or religious motive behind the shooting. Most people associate mental illness with mass shootings. We hear about a mass shooting, and many tend to assume the shooter must be mentally ill. Because who in their right mind brings a semi-automatic assault rifle and starts shooting at a middle school or at a concert? They must be mentally ill. But mental illness isn't found or diagnosed in all mass shooters. In fact, most mass shooters in modern history do not satisfy the diagnostic requirement for mental illness. While most might be considered emotionally disturbed, most don't meet the diagnostic requirements or they've never been officially evaluated. Stephen Paddock was never formally diagnosed with a mental illness, at least not of what we're aware of. However, many experts have said that in the years and months leading up to the shooting, Stephen displayed many antisocial personality traits. Antisocial personality is another common trait in mass murderers. Stephen was known to live a private and quiet life. He would sit at a video poker machine for hours on end and never speak to a single soul. He also had trouble maintaining personal relationships. These are all common traits in someone suffering from an antisocial personality. But antisocial personality disorder is never something that Stephen was diagnosed with. Experts say he might have displayed certain characteristics of antisocial personality or some other personality disorder, but he was never formally diagnosed. In the months and weeks leading up to October 1st, 2017, Stephen displayed red flags about what he was about to do. No one may have noticed them at the time, but he meticulously planned the shooting, a process that many mass shooters execute. They will carefully plan out every detail of their plan. In Stephen's case, he spent months researching different venues. One of his Google searches was how many people go to the Santa Monica Pier, indicating that he was considering other possible locations. He even at one point Googled how many people were planning to attend the concert in Las Vegas. He wanted to make sure that he picked a spot where he could target thousands of people. He also spent months assembling his arsenal of weapons. And once he prepped his arsenal, he arrived at Mandalay Bay a full week before the shooting so that he could plan and prepare down to the even smallest of details. By the time he checked into that suite, He knew exactly what he was going to do. During the last few months leading up to October 2017, news media reported that people close to Stephen reported that he constantly smelt like alcohol. These sources said that from the early morning hours of the day through the evening, Stephen smelt like alcohol, like he had spent most of the day drinking. Reports also indicated that Stephen had been prescribed several anti-anxiety medications, including Valium, in 2013, 2016, and then again in 2017. The last Valium prescription was reportedly made in June of 2017, about 4 months before the shooting. Now, there's no evidence to suggest that prescription drugs or alcohol was the cause or the motive in this case. But for the police and FBI to get the entire picture of who Stephen Paddock was and what he was doing leading up to the shooting, they have to consider matters like drugs and alcohol. When Valium is mixed with alcohol, the effects of both are amplified. Could drugs or alcohol have been involved in what happened that day? The police and FBI haven't found a significant connection. For the surviving victims of the Las Vegas shooting, their trauma lives on. The family members of the victims are still coping with grief. In September 2020, a court approved a settlement totaling $800 million from casino company MGM Resorts International and its insurers to more than 4,400 relatives and victims of the shooting. This settlement marks the conclusion of dozens of open lawsuits. Under the settlement, the MGM Hotel paid $49 million and its insurance company paid the remaining $751 million. The Mandalay Bay Hotel has since renumbered its floors. Floors 31 through 34 have been redesignated as floors 56 through 59. Room 32, 135, where Stephen Paddock executed his massacre, will never be reopened to guests. We might never know what was happening inside Stephen Paddock's mind, but here's my personal opinion. I think Stephen Paddock was a disturbed, lonely man who displayed very odd behavior in the months leading up to the shooting. His physical health was bad, and he was abusing alcohol. He seemed increasingly disengaged with his girlfriend, and I believed he was starting to experience financial trouble. In the months leading up to the shooting, he filled several prescriptions that might have negatively interacted with his heavy alcohol use. Although he was never formally diagnosed with any mental health issues, he had a history of showing a lack of empathy towards other people. I also believe that he'd become suicidal, and he also had a desire to achieve a certain degree of fame by committing a mass shooting. He wanted to be remembered for this. He might have wanted to be recognized as a famous criminal, just like his father. But I also believe that he wanted to be even more famous than his father ever was. He meticulously planned the shooting for months, and he wanted to be in control of everything that happened that night, including complete control over his own suicide. He was a man obsessed with firearms. He also may have shared some anti-government values, but this attack, his attack, wasn't driven by any extreme ideology. In my opinion, Stephen Paddock's actions can be explained by a combination of declining physical health, mental disturbances, suicidal ideations, and his desire to achieve a certain degree of fame. On October 1st, 2017, 58 innocent concertgoers were killed. Two additional victims died in the subsequent years. I want to honor these people, and I want us to remember them. I don't want us just to remember Stephen Paddock, the man behind this massacre. I want to name the victims, and I want to do my very best with pronouncing their names. Lisa Romero, Sonny Melton, Jordan McGildoon, Charleston Hatfield, Rachel Parker, Jenny Parks, John Phippen, Adrian Murfitt, Susan Smith, Sandra Casey, Karen Barnett, Hannah Allers, Nasa Tonks, Thomas Day Jr., Dana Gardner, Jessica Klimcock, Denise Burditis, Angela Gomez, Jennifer Irvine, Christopher Roybal, Rhonda Larroquet, Quinton Robbins, Bailey Schweitzer, Rocio Roca, Austin Meyer, Stacy Etchber, Carrie Galvin, Christiana Duarte, Jack Beaton, Kurt Von Tillow, Andrea Castilla, Brennan Stewart, Michelle Vo, Kaya Marie Madig, Denise Cohen, Derek Taylor, Brian Frazier, Steven Berger, Cameron Robinson, Christopher Eisencomb, Austin Davis, Jordan Rivera, Doreen Anderson, Victor Link, Carly Kibon, Teresa Kimura, Laura Shipp, Candace Bowers, Heather Alvarado, Patricia Mestis, Caroline Parsons, Brett Schwambeck, Tara Smith, Eric Silva, Kelsey Meadows, Melissa Ramirez, Billy Wolf Jr., Lisa Patterson, and Kim Gervis. If you or someone you know is in crisis, dial the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 provides 24/7 free and confidential support for victim in distress, prevention and crisis resources for you and your loved ones, and best practices for professionals in the United States. One more time, that's 988. If you'd like to help those victims affected by the shooting, please visit the Vegas Strong Resiliency Center website at vegasstrongrc.org. Anatomy of a Massacre is a Rockefeller Audio production. If you like the show and would like to support it, there are a number of ways you can help. For a small monthly contribution, you can help create new compelling cases for the show, help fund research, and assist with production and editing costs. For supporting the show, you'll become one of the first to listen to new ad-free episodes and snag exclusive show merchandise not available anywhere else. To learn about how you can support the show, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving a positive review. Sources for this episode include articles from ABC News, NPR, Business Insider, Yahoo, CNN, Newsweek, and the New York Times.